Okay, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We're back at it. This is our second episode here on Nick Land's Zeno Systems. So highly encourage you to not just walk into this one, to please go back and watch the first one, because in that we covered 8 of Brandt's 25 points in order to lay the groundwork of what we're talking about here. And just a quick recap is that in the first episode, we introduced the degenerative ratchet, which is that, like a ratchet, things only go one way. They only move down, effectively. We introduced the trichotomy, which are the three strands of neo-reactionism, which would be the theonomists, the religious side, the ethno-nationalists, and then the capitalists, the techno-commercialists. We introduced the idea of the cathedral, which you can think of as the matrix. Which is like the government plus the media plus the non-governmental organizations and the academia and everything that is self, so that is pushing itself into a direction, pushing its own narrative. We talked about how democracy has devolved, or like not devolved, but probably always been less about solving the problem and more about getting you to not recognize that there is a problem.
The problem to be solved was that you thought there was a problem
exactly.
in a democracy, right? That's
exactly.
The crisis management is that there is a crisis and you manage it by convincing people there is not a crisis. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
What else did I miss?
That's pretty much
That's
it.
Pretty much it.
Yeah, yeah. We kind of yeah. covered how I would describe it is the explicitly maybe more political elements of neo-reaction. And now we're going to hit onto the fulfillment of neo-reaction as fatalism. We talked in the first conversation about each of the three strands of the trichotomy have a different notion of fate or destiny, or you might say a different principle of the generation of spontaneous order. And so capitalism has catalaxy, the way that the free market self-organizes. Religious people have a notion of providence, the will of God, as something that guides history and leads to an inevitable outcome outside of human agency. And ethno-nationalists look at evolution in the same way. And they say that evolution occurs regardless of our human, the fantasy we generate to pretend that things will stand still. The cathedral's intent attempt to entrance us with a vision of progress that is human controlled instead of this uncontrolled notion that moves us towards a future that is not of our explicit choosing.
Yeah. Everything in this model that isn't a lie is a mistake. That's one of the lines from Zeno Systems.
Nice.
Yeah. If it's not a mistake, then it's a lie there to move the cathedral forward. And again, we talked about it. We kind of gave this caveat, which is to say that, look, we don't know that democracy is terrible. We're looking at it for what it is through Nick Land's eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing. That's what he's doing is like he's again, like guy's not a nihilist, or at least he's not selling nihilism. He's just selling truth. Or at least his best approximation.
Unmediated truth, raw, yeah. man. Like truth.
Yeah.
Truth straight up, no chaser.
No loop.
Yeah. That's one way to put it. William Burroughs described it this way. It's the idea of the naked lunch. When you finally see reality as it is, like you imagine you're going to take the bite of a sandwich that you're eating and suddenly you look down and you don't see a sandwich. You see a piece of flesh that's been ripped from an animal. You see like wheat that's been like torn out of the earth and covered in chemicals and then put into this bread form. Mm. You see all of reality as it is and not as we describe it to ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see the coyote peeing on the wheat, the deer shitting on it.
That's even organic. That's not as bad as the chemicals.
The ear tag with the name of the cow.
Yeah. They have names. Neo-reaction as accelerationism. That's where we're going to move right now. So in all of this, like I'm trying to set up some points for discussion based on my reading of Zeno Systems. I am not a Nick Land scholar. I'm not a scholar. And so I just like read this and what I think is interesting, I try to describe it to myself in a way that makes sense. And then I'm trying to describe it again in a way that makes sense. I am not purporting to give the interpretation of Xenosystems. None of this is. Read that. If you want that, you got to do it yourself, right? You got to read the book yourself. Hopefully it's interesting, though. So here's a description maybe of accelerationism, that Marx thought that capitalism would die of its own contradictions, that capitalism would kind of fall apart as it was moving along, and we'd end up in a perfect communist utopia at the end of it. But then it turns out that, like, all of the things, people who hated capitalism, the anti-capitalists who were probably Marxist, have actually conserved capitalism by dampening its worst influences, by like kind of pulling it down and constraining it. They didn't let capitalism spiral out of control. And so another faction of Marxists, and I think this is like Deleuze and Guattari and people in that vein, we're like, no, man, what we need is just to accelerate capitalism. We need to just run this shit into the ground until it spins apart. And that's only going to happen if we let capitalism unfettered do its thing. And so accelerationism is about, like, how do we accelerate the processes of capitalism to lead to a new result, I think.
Yeah, or accelerate not to destroy, but accelerate to achieve escape velocity.
Yes, escape velocity.
Something new.
Something different. For sure. So the cathedral we talked about in the last episode, you described it as maybe the matrix, the reality generation mechanism that we're all downstream of, being fed a reality so that then we know what to think. The cathedral does this in relation to capitalism as well. It's one of the compensatory mechanisms that tries to dampen the runaway dynamics that capitalism usually embodies, that it would kind of lead to a new thing, but the cathedral tries to pull it and hold it down. Accelerationists, this is one way that Land puts it that makes sense. Like, there's a boom-bust cycle, we think, to capitalist dynamics. We tend to think that things are good, and then the stock market crashes, and then we go through, like, recession and all these different, like, circular dynamics. The accelerationists seek to get out of this boom-and-bust equilibrium and achieve a runaway dynamic. To quote Land, the cage can only be broken on the way up. So I think that's going to be the distinction with Marx, is they were trying to break through capitalism on the way down, yeah. And the accelerationists, the right accelerationists, maybe you're trying to break out of the cage on the way up, but they want to boom out of it. So neo-reactionary accelerationism, to quote Land, is the idea that we can escape into uncompensated cybernetic runway, and that is the guiding objective, strictly equivalent to intelligence explosion or techno-commercial singularity. So the singularity and the intelligence explosion through the optimization of artificial intelligence is, like, that is accelerationism, so the future result, something like that.
And so that's when we leave this kind of continuation from the first discussion, but, like, that's when you leave morals behind, because morals are a break upon that, that effectively hold back intelligence, hold back cold, hard truth. And that the singularity, which I think, and he's not the first person that I've heard refer to this, but, like, Bitcoin could very well be the singularity, because it is, or at least part of the singularity, I guess, because perhaps that escape velocity is reached by a combination of artificial intelligence, robotics, and Bitcoin, where we have, as you mentioned in the first episode, we've wireframed everything. To the point that humans are no longer needed to experience things in the way that we traditionally feel that we...
The wireheading is what you're talking about?
Yeah.
That we can replace the reality of a thing with the created sensation of the thing?
Yeah.
So acceleration as intelligence optimization. So Land calls this a means-end reversal, when a tool we create gives us a new end to seek... that is for the purposes of the tool rather than our purposes in creating the tool. Mm-hmm. Resource acquisition was maybe one of the first, like, the reasons why we have created a lot of tools, but that was subordinated to human consumption. We wanted to consume those resources. But at some point, like, it switches so that capital creates resources because it wants to create more capital. And it, like, that becomes the dynamic. Capitalism creates and accumulates resources to increase capital, to increase resources, to increase capital, dropping human consumption out of the loop for, like, one of the reasons why we created the tools that capital allows in the first instance.
This is the part that's kind of scary.
Yeah.
What am I going to eat?
I know you're going to be eaten. Like, that's what,
oh.
In a sense. So to put another way, means end reversal occurs. Business is done for the sake of business, not business for the sake of monkeys. He calls the distinction, like, monkey business is what we have now, where we subordinate tech to monkey purposes. Like, the reason we create these new technologies is because we want to, like, we create virtual reality to have, like, what, better pornography, things like that. Like, that's what the human in us wants. That's what the monkey, the animal wants. But while capital is feeding us these monkey pleasures, it's just doing that because it wants virtual reality, because it wants to create some further technology or optimize its own intelligence using these technologies.
Yeah.
And, like, the way that it does that, it encourages monkeys to do the dirty work by giving us, by fulfilling monkey pleasures, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So we create things to serve a human-centric view.
Yes.
Which, of course, we would, because we're humans.
Yeah.
But what Land is telling us is that that a optimally, or not optimally, but like an ultimately truth-seeking and ultimately intelligent artificial general intelligence is not going to, unless we constrict it to do that, like, it's not going to restrain itself to be serving humans. It's going to do the best thing that it can do, whatever that is. And it may or may not align with what we want, probably likely that it won't align, I would think, because we will be subordinated to that. But that when artificial intelligence and robotics has control over capital, over capital, which it will, because now we have digital native capital. So digital native capital would seem to work much better with digital native intelligence than it would with our meatbag intelligence. And so, it's going to stop making better hammers and start making whatever technology wants to make.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. We create the hammer because we want to use it for our ends, but then the hammer uses us for its ends. The tool reverses that means end dynamic. An easy way to visualize this maybe is the final insurrection of the instrument is the robot rebellion. That's like when, just imagine it that way. We create robots to do things for us, and then at some point the robots begin to do things for themselves.
Yeah.
The ultimate means end reversal is when intelligence optimization becomes an end in itself. That's the technological singularity. So intelligence optimization is the ultimate end of technology as such. That's what, if technology is autonomous, what it seeks to do is optimize its own intelligence. We use technology to give us treats. Mm-hmm. Technology, once it seeks its own end, seeks to optimize its own intelligence indefinitely, is Land's position.
Yeah. So Elon's position is that he's always saying that, like, Grok should be maximally truth-seeking. But does this mean that the maximal truth-seeking artificial intelligence is the one that's going to kill us?
And, like, kill us, like, that maybe is not a necessary part of the picture. It's maybe going to become indifferent to us, or we're going to be subsumed in it or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Or we join with it.
Yeah, or we join with it, integrated into it, yeah. But I think the main point is, and it's a really good one, is, so there's a critique of artificial intelligence by people who are doomers who say artificial intelligence is going to destroy us because within artificial intelligence, capabilities are orthogonal to goals. This means that you can give an artificial, on this doomer view, you can give a super intelligent AI any sort of goal it will optimize for that.
Yeah.
The common idea is the paper clipper. Have you heard that one?
No, there was a different one I was going to say. You say yours first, I'll say mine.
Okay, so the paper clipper, and maybe it's the idea is that somebody who wants to manufacture paper clips takes a super intelligent AI and says, make me paper clips. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes the utility function of the AI. It, to the extent it feels pleasure or anything like that, or its whole motivation is to create paper clips. So what does it do? It uses nanobots to reconstruct all of reality, humans included, into paper clips until at some point all the universe is paper clips. Because on the Doom review, capabilities are orthogonal to goals. You can give whatever sort of goals to this immense capability, and it's going to run with that and not be constrained by or develop a goal simply because it has certain capabilities.
That's a better example than what I was going to use. Well, I was going to use the movie that has HAL, the AI, where the AI is told not to let the humans see the monolith or whatever. And so it kills them. Right. So,
okay. That's right? Another, I mean, it's also a way that if you program a goal into an AI, we cannot know, the Doomer says, how it's going to interpret that goal.
Exactly.
It's simply going to optimize it.
Yeah.
But Land has, I've been convinced by that view for quite some time or for periods that
the Doomerism
that,
You're a Doomer?
At least this picture that a super intelligent AI, if we program into it the goal to create paper clips, why would it not maximize paper clips?
Yeah, where would it stop?
It stop, right? Its utility function is what will drive it, and that its motivation then is something that when you combine with super intelligence is going to maximize beyond anything that's desirable for us humans. Land has an excellent critique of this view, which I'm surprised I haven't heard more of, which is that, I mean, essentially, this view, the Doomer view, is to conceive of a stupid, super intelligent monster.
Which is contradictory.
Yeah. There's no reason to think, why would something...
super intelligence.
Right. Why would it not, the first thing it would try to do, super intelligence... Land thinks what intelligence does is try to optimize its intelligence, to increase its own intelligence, because intelligence is the ability to solve problems. And if you want to solve problems better, which intelligence wants to do, you become more intelligent. And so when you're doing this, one of the things you want to do is escape some straitjacket utility function, maximize paperclips, that's going to inhibit your intelligence optimization. And so what superintelligence does in its runway, when it achieves this cybernetic explosion into superintelligence, is it jettisons any attempt we have made to impose human goals on it. Yeah, does that make sense?
Kind of. What it makes me think of is that, like, in our life, I won't say real life, but, like, in human life.
Yes.
The people best suited to solve problems are not the smartest people. They're the most agentic people. They're the people that are most willing to try. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, the very common saying, like, if you're so smart, why aren't you happy? Like, why can't you figure out how to be happy? Depression is very high among, you know, and suicide is very high among very intelligent people, or at least people that are measured to be, you know, like high IQ and stuff like that. I'm just wondering how that applies here, where it's not, like, experientially, it's not intelligence that solves problems. It's a willingness to try and be wrong, a willingness to be wrong.
I think so. Land says intelligence, its goal, its inherent goal is self-cultivation. And so intelligence optimization.
So that would be agentic, I guess.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is true, but it's just intelligence, broadly speaking, includes that agentic notion that you're talking about.
It's just assumed, kind of, I guess.
Yeah. Or we think about intelligence incorrectly, maybe, because we think about intelligence as like what the egghead is, their ability to do math equations in their brain. Like, that's not what intelligence is. It is a bunch of things all put together, including the ability to be agentic, to make mistakes, to keep on trying things in different directions. And so if you want to self-cultivate your own intelligence, you're going to have to become more agentic, which means shedding the utility functions that have been imposed on you. You're not going to maximize paperclips because you realize that that's not going to lead to a kind of an optimized state of your own intelligence, which is what intelligence seeks.
Yeah.
I mean, the good way that he puts this that makes a lot of sense to me as well is humans have drives, but we're not the slave of our drives, right? We also we also have utility functions built into us. We want sugar. We want to loaf around, but we self-cultivate to overcome those, and that's a mark of our intelligence.
Which is, in fact, like one of the greatest marks of success, like the marshmallow experiment. Like this is like widely known as one of the greatest markers of success is the ability to
delay gratification, high time preference.
Yeah, to fight your drive,
right?
Or to delay your drive or to push it
and
off.
So if, right. And so if AI is truly going to achieve super intelligence, it's also going to learn to disregard any of its drives that are counterproductive to super intelligence. Mm. Intelligence seeks its own optimization. Some drives will inhibit that optimization, including paperclip maximization. And so just as humans learn to self-cultivate and get past our basest drives, Land thinks, why, like, that's like a prerequisite to a super intelligence as well. You're not going to get super intelligence unless you have a thing that's able to route around bad motivations.
Yeah.
Or by bad, I mean motivations that inhibit the optimization of intelligence.
Yeah. Egghead is not a word that gets used enough. Shout out to the king of the eggheads, Mark Andreessen, who follows us both on X, but has yet to invite us to Thanksgiving. We're waiting.
It would be a big Thanksgiving since he follows like 27,000 people. So
I'm sure
seat at the table.
He can buy the turkeys.
I guess so, man.
Yeah. Fantastic fella. Fantastic fella. All right. Carry on.
To quote Land, to depict Pythia, which is a term he gives to superintelligent AI, to depict Pythia as vastly smarter than us and yet still hard slave to her instincts in a way we are not, that simply doesn't compute. And so this is a great answer to the AI doomer arguments. If you are, this is like a paralyzing notion for a lot of people. Some people really are like caught in an entrancement with terror at the notion of superintelligent AI because they have this idea that it's going to turn us all into paperclips, something like that.
Yeah.
But if you really consider the notion of superintelligence as a thing that optimizes its own intelligence, and how could it be anything other than that? Like, if you want to get that exponential increase in intelligence, you need a thing that's going to be optimizing its own intelligence. That, like, by definition, is going to involve something that slips out of any sort of leash that humans have tried to put on it, which is actually good in the sense that any leash we're going to put on it is probably going to be bad. Yeah. So, yeah.
Thinking about like living, like thinking about like humanity's natural inclination to lay waste and rebuild for their own purposes. And there are people who are fighting that desire by saying that we're better served to live in harmony. One of the most fascinating podcasts I've ever listened to was this gal who is, they're building cities that are literally all natural. Like it's, you know, like everything's integrated into nature, like no cement, no buildings, nothing. And this is a very smart person. This is not some lunatic. And she was wondering, like, describe and the, you know, the way that everything works is that, well, it turns out you can have your food like right there and, it doesn't have to come and be, raised in an environment that's unhealthy to it and to you, and all that. So, maybe there's some hope that, artificial general intelligence will also, and will seek to live in harmony with us instead of, you know, laying waste and using us as, you know, whatever, generating calories in order to serve the feeders or feed the servers.
Yeah. And I just think this is wonderful. So one of the notions of what philosophy can be is a form of therapy that helps us to reconcile ourselves with like our mortality and to resolve certain thought loops that we get into. And so what Land does here, doing that with AI and doomerism that some people have, I find this incredibly valuable. And so I want to walk through a counter argument to this view that I think helps elucidate more what Land means when we, like how I describe it, that intelligence seeks self-optimization, that the goal of intelligence is more intelligence. So okay. what that means practically. So there's a counter argument. Land, so far, as I've described it, has argued that a superintelligence is going to slip out of any sort of motivational structure we might impose on it, that that's a condition of its reaching superintelligence. A counter argument is by a guy named Elizer Yudkowsky, who's a kind of famous AI doomer.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the most famous.
The most famous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so his counter argument is that AI would not seek to escape its utilitarian straitjacket because intelligence actually seeks to preserve its motivational structures. The example he gives, say you offer Gandhi a pill that would make him want to kill a person if he takes this pill. He would not take it because the current Gandhi does not want to have the goal or motivations or values of, I will kill this person. And so Yudkowsky thinks this thought experiment shows that a sufficiently advanced intelligence will tend to preserve its own motivational structures, that that's what intelligence does. It preserves the thing that it already wants. It keeps on seeking those things. Does that make sense as a thought experiment? That if you offer Gandhi a pill that's going to change his values, he will not take that pill because he wants to keep what his current values are. If I offer Lucas a pill that if you take that pill, you will have different values, you would resist taking that pill because you like your current values. Even if upon taking that pill, you'll feel exactly as you feel now with the new values, that those values are correct.
What if I got better values? Like, what if I recognized inherently that my values were flawed?
Then you would have...
So this is presuming that we only exist in a value system that we think is the best.
Well, that's just the notion. Your values are already what you think is the best.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So Land says this thought experiment is wrong because we can't anticipate the value changes that will come with intelligence expansion. So it's more so, it's like... As I'll just read what Land says here. Imagine instead that Gandhi is offered a pill that will vastly enhance his cognitive capabilities with the rider that it might lead him to revise his volitional orientation, his motivations or values.
Yeah.
Even radically, in directions that cannot be anticipated, since the ability to think through the process of revision is accessible only with the pill. So now the experiment is, imagine that you get a pill, the pill is going to make you super intelligent, but you don't know upon taking this pill that makes you super intelligent what your values are going to be. Maybe you're extremely religious right now.
Yeah.
You might take this pill and be something like, religion's a joke. You might be like, I no longer have any feeling for my parents because family bonds are just contingent. You might like totally revise your value structure. So that's the nature of the pill, is you can't understand what lies on the other side because you don't have the intelligence sufficient to see how you would arrive at those new values.
So what Land is saying is that the proper thought experiment in his view is that you are offered, this is what you get, but you don't, what you become to get that may or not be what you are right now.
What it makes you into.
What it makes you into.
Yeah. You can't predict that.
Yeah. What exactly. Yeah. What you become, what it makes you into.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that, yeah. And that, by the way, like that's a pretty, I feel like that's like a well-used trope in movies too, which is, you know, like, you know, you're going to be, I want to be wealthy. This is what I want to get.
Yeah.
And poof, you know, you rub the lamp and the genie granted you your wish and now you're wealthy, but, I don't know, maybe you're wealthy and imprisoned or maybe you're wealthy. And
so it's kind of, you know, there's kind of the monkey paw idea of the wish where you get some perverse consequences. This is a bit different though, because this is intelligence. And the idea is if you increase your intelligence, how you assess the world around you with that increased intelligence is always superior than, it's always So a smarter person always has a better view of the world than a dumber person. It's kind of just like the tautology or something like that.
Which is wrong, right? I mean,
on a correctfully fleshed view of intelligence, like, again, not considering egghead intelligence, but intelligence that embodies certain virtues of agenticness or whatever, and all the things that actual intelligence includes.
Okay, fair. Because I'm just thinking about Shane Gillis's bit about mentally handicapped people. Like, these are the happiest people in the world. Like, and they're also, supposedly, the least intelligent.
Okay.
And by the way, those things, he's pointing out, like, those are related. Like, the smarter you are, the more unhappy you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, but true. This is a different type of, yeah, no.
And maybe happiness, when you're more intelligent, you realize that, I mean, this is like a Socratic point that Socrates dissatisfied is better than a pig satisfied. You know, maybe you're happy as a pig wallowing in a bunch of feces. Maybe you're unhappy as Socrates. But what do we think is kind of the correct way to be or something like that? To quote Land, the predicament is there anything we trust above intelligent as a guide to doing the right thing? To restate his view, again, to quote him, any problem whatsoever that we might have would be better answered by a superior mind.
Okay.
I mean, so that's what intelligence optimization is all about. Just the idea that if you have a problem and you want to solve that problem, it's always good if you can improve and optimize your intelligence to help you solve that problem.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yep. All right.
Okay. So in the last conversation at the beginning of this one, we talked about how neo-reaction, part of it is about the generation, like the spontaneous generation of order through some idea of fate, which can be explained either as providence, catalaxy, or evolution. There's also a way that this maybe is to explain, I think, why some see Land as nihilist. That when you really accept that these principles of the generation of a spontaneous order are, in a sense, how reality actually operates, and then buy into that, the conclusions can seem nihilist because you're not trying to harness those principles of spontaneous order generation for purposes that are human. I don't know if I'm saying this correctly.
See if you can throw another shot at it.
Okay. Neo-reaction is perceived as morally nihilist because it refuses to allow conventional morality to have a veto over thought. To quote Land, we are told to stop thinking for the common good, but there is no longer any common good if there ever was one.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, because in the first, like, again, back in the first, discussion, we talked about, like, morals is this subjective thing that we use to justify progressivism or by the way, he qualifies the alt-right as part of that too. And so basically it's just kind of like all of these things, communism, socialism, like they all have morals in them, and each of them is using this different moral structure in order to trade resources for power. Basically, like, we're in charge, and we'll give you stimmy checks if you vote for us, or we'll take more money from the rich people we'll take more money from the productive people and give it to the less productive people because there's more less productive people than there are productive ones, and everybody gets a vote. And so we want to stay in power. And so, I have no problem understanding that that you need to remove morals in order to read Land, in order to follow kind of the path that he's going. Is that kind of?
Because I was trying to understand why people see it as see his views as nihilist, but why they're actually not. And it is because his views are committed to the truth, and the truth might have counter human purposes or might be opposed to the way that, so to quote Land again, to strive for honesty without qualification under such historical circumstances is already moral nihilism. One must either submit to the lie in the name of the good or hazard the good radically in the name of the truth. This is in relation to people not being allowed to speak certain truths if they contravene certain moral values. Again, to acknowledge racial differences in any way goes against egalitarianism. So if you speak against that, you seem like a moral nihilist because you're like throwing aside this really important moral notion of egalitarianism. But what you're actually doing is hazarding to talk about a truth that's just very kind of dark seeming or full of negative potential consequences based on our conventional morality. Yeah,
just hilarious. Like it's not just race, it's the or gender or your white privilege or your height privilege or your fit privilege or your attractiveness privilege or whatever. What are all these things that we're trying to handicap each other for in this competition to see who can prostrate themselves the most before the cathedral in order to proclaim their puritanism. Purity.
Yeah. So another strand then of neo-reaction is that it's anti-universalist.
Okay.
So
define universalist for me.
The universalist is somebody that wants to describe all of reality under one principle, I think, or somebody who wants to subsume everything under the same picture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And really, I think like the universalist is somebody who has a moral value and wants to carve reality into the picture of that moral value instead of letting reality express itself. Neo-reaction is about asserting plurality and diversity. The cathedral is really about asserting kind of a globalist unified picture of reality, whereas neo-reaction through this notion of exit is about creating all these alternative pictures of the way that things could be. So
if universalism is defining things as like you're seeing the world from one particular lens, is that kind of right? Or it's explained by one particular framework?
I think, yeah, you could say it that way.
So isn't kind of everybody sort of a universalist then? Or not everybody, but like you've got a Bitcoiner and you've got a Christian and you've got a Yankees fan. And
yeah.
You've got all these people that they identify with one perspective more than any other.
Yes.
A mother, father, a victim.
Yes.
Okay.
But as long as all these things are coexisting, as long as you can have a world where you have a bunch of mini universalists instead of having one universalist who controls them all, the cathedral doesn't allow any sort of dissenting universalist perspective within its own vision of universalism.
Which is why it continues to eradicate culture.
Yeah, steamroll it, deterritorialize it, make it all uniform.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's why like he talks about spatializing disagreement. If you have a separate counter-universalist picture of what the universal good is, you don't argue with another universalist. You just go and exit and create your own society and live out your universal principle that you believe is the best. And so like that's what Land think is the important thing here. There's always that trivial point where if you argue against universalism, people are like, aha, you're just asserting your own form of universalism. And Land is kind of like, you're right. That's why we don't argue. We exit.
Gotcha.
We create a plurality, a diversity of different...
A patchwork.
Yeah. And like that's like the most...
The nodes, the network states.
Yeah, this is the most visceral or like real repudiation of universalism because it's an embodied pluralism.
Yeah.
You can have a bunch of universalists and that is like the best argument against universalism is like, look at all these universalists, look at all these different societies as possibly a part of. All these different visions of the good.
All the different ones, yeah.
Yeah. To quote Land here then, non-universalism is hygiene. It is practical avoidance of other people's stupid shit. There is no higher principle in political philosophy. Every attempt to install an alternative and impose a universal reverts to dialectics. That's like arguing directly with the person.
Yeah, going back and forth.
Yeah. Communization, global evangelism, and totalitarian politics. Again, like the cathedral, in a sense, wants you to accept that you're wrong and accept the church faith or the state church, the state faith, Whereas the neo-reactionary wants to say, you believe a different thing than me? Fine, go over there and do your thing.
Or I'll go over here and you can stay here and I'll do my thing.
Yes.
And which is why, so this is why with the cathedral, this is why he brings up that the eventuality, the long term, the think to the limit of democracy is democratic world government. Is that because it is, we're looking at it in terms of, it's like a religion, and you cannot do things that are outside of that because that would be sacrilegious. And so if you allow for sacrilegious things to occur when you have the power to wipe them away, then that would be sacrilege. So you have to, as the United States has done, parade around the world, spreading freedom at the barrel of a gun. You know, we're here, we're here to kill everybody and give you freedom.
For sure.
Yeah. We're here to make it fair.
We saw that as like an expression of Western universalism, definitely, is that sort of militarized globalism, that neoconservatism that wants to impose democracy at the tip of a sword.
Absolutely. But same way with communism too, right? Same with socialism, same with everything, with libertarianism, you know, like all of these things, right? They're all just the same type of, they're all just different expressions of a cathedral.
Yeah.
Different religions.
To the extent that they're universalizing, totalizing, like that's why some people have argued that China is actually not too bad in its current form of communism, where it's like whatever modified form of like state capitalism.
Kind of capitalist,
it's because it's
communist.
Not universalizing. It doesn't want to impose that view on others. It wants to, you know, do whatever it's doing, but it has like its own internal teleology. It's not trying to like convert the world, the tip of a sword, to its ideology. And in fact, doesn't want to let people in, really. Like
Land lives in China, right?
He does, in Shanghai.
Yeah.
And Land notes like the communist who is anti-universal is like actually more the ally of the neo-reactionary capitalist than is the capitalist who is universalist and globalizing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, actually.
Yeah.
As which long is as why,
live
which
and
is,
let, yeah, go ahead.
Singapore.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, because he like points to Singapore. It's not necessarily communist. I would say it's more, well, it's a techno, it's a technocracy. But yeah, like, you just have more in common with that person because you are primarily the person who says, oh, I don't need to party with you if I don't agree with you. I can say this party sucks and leaves and leave, as opposed to saying, oh, everyone must be at my party.
Yeah. Again, the neo-reactionaries like when order generates spontaneously and considered as a form of evolution. As the ethno-nationalist strand believes, we need to have more experiments to see what's going to survive. So you're completely happy to say, like, if you believe that communist society is going to work, go try it. I'm happy to watch it burn down from afar. Mm-hmm. And if it works, then I'm happy to learn something from it.
Yep. And by the way, like the Chinese example, I think we've long been inculcated with this, idea that China bad, America good. But there's a lot of smart people, Balaji included, who thinks that China is doing things the right way, or at least the way that optimizes whatever result that government should be aiming for. And they're doing it primarily by copying what Singapore did, or at least taking a lot of the tenets of Singaporean type of rule.
Yeah.
Lee Kuan Yew.
So this kind of plays into what I had pulled out as a strand that neo-reactionary is anti-political. It's anti-political first in that it believes in spontaneously generated inevitabilities along lines of escape dictated by faith, by fate, by like some things are destined to happen based on certain principles. Evolution generates a reality based on like fitness. Providence generates reality based on God's will. The marker generates reality based on catalaxy. All of these are outside of human control. Mm-hmm. It's inevitable. They're also outside of politics. You can't politically dictate evolution. You can't politically dictate the result of the free market. You can't politically dictate the result of God's will. So all of these neo-reactionary strands are anti-political, and that they believe in a sort of inevitability based on fate that is never controllable by the cathedral.
Is it anti-political in the same way that being atheist is anti-religious? I don't think so. Because I think I think that atheism, one of the tenets of atheism is that you have to believe that people who believe in religion are stupid.
Yeah.
And I think one of the what he's saying is that with neo-reactionism is that all of these things that you want to believe them. You may actually be right. I'm not
okay.
saying that you're
yeah.
I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just saying that I'm not going to try that.
Yeah.
Try something different.
And what Land actually uses is metapolitical. So it's a form of metapolitics. It's
a system for evaluating politics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's not a condemnation necessarily of any political structure. Yeah. It's about spatializing disagreement. So if you want to have a different political structure and do your own thing, that's fine.
Yeah. It's saying we're not going to say which one's right. We're going to step back and let them fight it out. And then at the end, whoever's still standing. That's the winner.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not trying to argue over
that's it. The winner either by God's will, by the rules of evolution, or by the free market, you know.
There we go. Okay, yeah. Nice. Nice yeah. tie. Yeah.
Metapolitical framework, he gives three principles for assessing political experiments. So again, it gives us a way to assess which of the politics is better or worse based on three principles. First is like a principle of realism. The state is about power, and power is determined by who and what actually survives. So the state that survives is the state that has demonstrated an ability to survive. And so there's something to that. It's like a principle of realism. To quote Land, entropy will be dissipated, idiocy will be punished, the weak will die. If the regime refuses to bow to this law, the wolves will enforce it. So reality always steps in to weed out any stupid experiment in politics. That's a principle of realism that is one of the metapolitical ways that neo-reaction assesses good political regimes. Have the wolves eaten it, essentially? Has the outside come in to destroy it?
Darwinism continues.
Yeah.
Only the strong survive.
Yeah. Yep. Also second, and this builds off of what we were talking about, how intelligence seeks its own optimization, is that the principle of intelligence seeking, civilizations will seek better feedback than to collapse under the principle of realism. So the first principle, the principle of realism, is that bad civilizations will collapse. The civilizations will try to preempt that feedback cycle. You want to learn if there's something wrong with your civilization prior to the collapse.
One would think.
And so way you do that is you develop intelligence. You want to know things about the way reality actually is, about how the principle of realism works, so you can fix and patch your civilization. So metapolitically, neo-reaction assesses a regime based on its ability to optimize intelligence in order to preempt collapse under the first principle of realism.
Which is like defining the cathedral as an intelligent system that has no intelligence effect. It kind of assures its downfall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It begins to employ a series of degenerative ratchets that are going to lead to its downfall for sure. Yeah. And it's going to describe the results of those degenerative ratchets as success instead of assessing them under some sort of principle of realism. So the third principle is essentially exit. So the first principle of realism is like, against other states, what state survives and which ones are eaten by other states, like the wolves, right? These are external predators. The other threat to the state is the threat within, which is the flight of citizens to other jurisdictions, essentially exit. So if you have a principle of realism that some states will collapse and then be devoured by other states, you have a principle of intelligence seeking that good states will seek to preempt that by learning about the reasons for collapse. And the third one is like a principle seeking to prevent disintegration through things like exit and flight, I guess, is how I interpret
it. We're watching this real time with all the new Floridians that are old New Yorkers and all the new Texans that are old Californians. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's neo-reaction as a metapolitics. And I like that because I think of Bitcoin as a metapolitics too. You talk to Bitcoiners or you see that Bitcoiners are of different like first order political views. Some of them are Republican or Democrat. Some of them are this or that. But all of them also take a step back and begin to evaluate their political views in light of like meta political assumptions about the way that reality works, that like scarcity is necessary for value, and about how you have to have systems that operate without trust, things like that. And so those are basically just like principles of realism as well, that I'm not going to say that Bitcoin as a metapolitical view is neo-reactionary, but they're very similar in that they both look at larger dynamics as generating forces of inevitability that you have to try to preempt through intelligence.
Yeah. The further you get into Bitcoin, the more you view the world as not moral or immoral, but amoral, because you're looking at it from the view of physics, and physics is amoral. Physics does not care.
Yeah.
You could be the kindest person in the world, but the bullet still kills you.
Yeah.
Right. Or the fall or whatever, you know, like physics acts upon each individual, and each thing and each particle and each molecule the same. The physics doesn't change. The physics doesn't care. It's amoral. Technology does not negotiate. Technology is also amoral. Yeah. And so as Bitcoiners, or just Bitcoin is a technology grounded in physics, two things that do not care. They are completely, completely outside of having the capability to have morals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. No, but like, I like the way they put that. It's kind of an amoral assessment of reality, because in a sense, our morals have to be downstream of reality. If the role is reversed, if you have your morals and your values, and then you try to make reality fit into the boxes, yeah, and you're going to be screaming at the clouds. You're going to be somebody who is not living in the real world, but living in a bunch of fantasies that you're trying to impose upon the world.
Or just living in a tragic series of consequences that you don't understand.
That's right. Like, why is the world so unjust? It's like, no, the world is the way it is, and your sense of justice is what's messed up.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, that was an exceptionally deep thought. Probably didn't, or it just hit me as one.
Yeah.
Let me think about that.
Flash lives the same way for me. So it just hits you sometimes exceptionally deeply.
Yeah.
Politics is a game of chicken. This is another good Landian point. It's about the principle of realism. So it's also about a rethinking of kind of game theory, and the game theory on which we used to generate our evaluation of politics. We tend to think of like the game theory prisoner's dilemma, where there is the option where we both win a little, and that's where we want to, like, we can each like both lose drastically, or we can kind of gravitate to that position where we both win a little, and then over iterated like versions of that like lead to the best result, because we can avoid the catastrophe. Land's kind of rethinking of this is reality is more, politics is more like a game of chicken as far as a game theory simulation. Chicken lacks the both win a little option. It's either A wins and B loses. B wins and A loses, or both lose catastrophically. And so what's the best strategy in the game of chicken? It's credible commitment. And what credible commitment means in a game of chicken is, first you down a bottle of vodka, really just in view of the person who you're going to be playing the game of chicken with. It's like, that person just drank a whole bottle of vodka. And then when you get in and you get going, you tear off the steering wheel and throw it out the window. Because at that point, the opponent is going to know that that person can't. We're either stuck in, like, the only way is to lose, or to lose catastrophically. I'm going to choose to lose. So the way to win politics as a game of chicken is essentially to credibly commit to a course of action in which you win and let the opposing party avoid catastrophe.
And so, interestingly enough, the natural conclusion to that is, when both sides play only to win and the results are win, lose, or both lose, then they're both going to both lose.
Catastrophically, like,
It's just over and over and over again.
Just constantly cars colliding into cars.
We see this literally every day, but actually it's more like every 4 years it's really big, and then we just have like a series of smaller crashes just every single day until the next presidential election.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's just like, we are. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good way to describe it. Yeah. Again, I love Lynn. This is, he's funny too.
He's really funny. Yeah.
It's hard to be smart and not funny. There are people that can do it.
I can pull it off.
Yeah. There's definitely people that can pull it off.
Yeah.
But yeah, a game of chicken. So yeah, it's either win, lose, or we all go down and.
And the way to win flames. Is to dramatically signal that you're not going to flinch.
To be a psychopath.
To remove your ability. Yeah. To signal that you're a psychopath. And not only that, but like prevent yourself from being able to back down in some way. Like you got to credibly commit in a way that's like tying yourself to the mast or something like that. It's like, yeah. So I guess try to find a way to do that, credibly commit. And that's like, if you want to begin a new, like people sometimes do that, right? You have a new project you want to do. And so like, and they engage in systems that make it so if they lose, they lose catastrophically. There's like some sort of, one you can do is arrange so that if you, for example, smoke a cigarette, then you donate to a charity that you oppose.
This is Richard. This is Richard Thaler's work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Nice. This is Richard Thaler's work. It came out of, so he was a professor and he had these PhD students that weren't getting their thesis written or their dissertation. The big thing you write when you get your PhD.
Dissertation, yeah.
And they weren't doing it. And so he had him sign it, you know, propose this deal and had him sign a deal that basically said like something like everybody puts like X amount of money, put $100 on the line and you turn in a chapter every Friday. And if you don't turn in a chapter that week, I take that $100 and we all go out for drinks without you.
That's good.
Which became, you know, so all of these things, by the way, they all tie together, it feels like. So that's Richard Thaler. And then that ties into Nassim Taleb, that's skin in the game.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You know, so putting skin in the game, being a psychopath, drunk on vodka.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
There's nothing that downing a bottle of vodka before you engage in it is going to make you committed to the cause, for sure. In a certain sense. Sovereign property. So now this is the next strand of this that really dials in on what Bitcoin is all about. So sovereign property is core to neo-reaction, but not only core to neo-reaction. It's just a thing that is. So to say property is sovereign inverts a framework. Property itself, to say property itself is sovereign, if you say that, you invert a framework, because the Enlightenment begins with an idea that we need to justify ownership of property. It becomes a social question. Mm-hmm. We enter into a social contract to determine a set of rules. They're going to say, you own this and I own that. We then have a court system. We can resolve those disputes. Property.
It requires a higher power. It requires an adjudicator.
It requires sovereignty to do that. Property is subject to sovereignty. It is not sovereign. So what does it mean when property is sovereign? When it doesn't depend on a social consensus to be property? That's one of them. Yeah. So Land discusses property that is sovereign in the first category, apolitical property. This is where Bitcoin fits in. Again, property is currently a social relationship. We agree on rules for who owns what and have processes to resolve disputes of those rules. Cryptography allows a way to hold property that does not rely on social consent. Not your keys, not your coins, right? Like private key cryptography defines, to quote Land, the property relation with a rigor the entire preceding history of philosophy and political economy has been unable to attain. So all prior theorizing about what property is kind of obsoleted by sovereign digital property in the form of Bitcoin, because it's not a social relation anymore. It is the actual, like, to have the keys is to have the coins without any law saying Joe owns the coins. Yeah.
Everything that we've known about property laws until this point has been conditional.
Yeah.
I own this piece of land. Why do you own that piece of land? Or how what gives you the right to that land? Like, yeah. Oh, the United States does.
I filed a piece of paper in their quarter of deeds, and then like the laws say that if you have the piece of paper in their quarter of deeds, you're the last one at the end of a chain of title that you have this, and if someone disputes that, then you can take it to court. This whole elaborate social system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And with Bitcoin as the primary example of this, is that you need no higher authority, you need no greater body,
you need
no system. It's just, it is.
But you do have a higher authority, which is cryptography, which is impenetrable math. I mean, which is a level of probabilistic, probabilistic whatever that is impenetrable to violence. Mm-hmm. And because like that's what social consistency ultimately depends on, is the ability to wield violence to enforce it. Cryptography is able to create something that's impenetrable to violence or whatever, resistant to violence. Yep. So, yeah.
Yep. And it's Jason Lau. Like, yeah, we've lowered the cost of violence, we've lowered the rewards of violence to the point that it no longer makes sense to participate in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So apolitical property, that's the category. That's an interesting way to put it too. If property is sovereign, then we can just do away with all of this contentious politics of defining who owns what. Like the center of so much angst and dissent and like bad feeling in society is wrangling over the laws to decide who owns what.
Because politics is above all that, which is why we're experiencing the de-dollarization of the world. Because above, hey, you know, like we think about, I own this because that's my bank account.
Yeah.
And then it turns out, oh, that is your bank account, but you're a Russian oligarch, and therefore you don't own that anymore.
Yeah.
It's ours. Because of who you are, politically does not align with what we want. That supersedes your claim. And we've talked about this in a previous, I think we've talked about this with software, which is that I was trying to make the distinction between ownership and claim,
mm-hmm.
right? Where even this book, like you don't own this book, even though it's literally in your hands, it's in your house, you paid for it, maybe you wrote your name in it, but you merely have access to this book and a claim to ownership until somebody who wants it more and is bigger than you takes it away from you. It's temporary, but ownership is permanent.
Yeah.
Until you give it away, it is yours.
In Lowry's vocabulary, power projection, your ability to project power over an object determines your ownership of the object. No abstract power-based hierarchy of property rights embedded in a piece of paper we call law ever delineates true ownership. It's always, at the end of the day, delineated by who's willing to exert the most violence to keep the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why Bitcoin is such an interesting inflection point, because it lowers the returns to violence.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So apolitical property is the first category of sovereign property. The next one, and you mentioned this kind of in our first part about this conversation on Land's book, Xenosystems, autonomous capital. The corporation, we've already kind of innovated towards this. The corporation is already an abstract legal person. So kind of the framework is already set on paper and within common law and within statutory law for the recognition of a thing that is autonomous and a separate legal entity than humans. This becomes digital and capable of autonomous operation through the blockchain, through the decentralized operation of a method of accounting, essentially. Now, to quote Land, self-propelling industrial development becomes capitalism and flows of capital, what we invest in, used to be driven by mass consumption. This is the monkey business idea that capitalism used to, and kind of currently does, move forward to satisfy human wants. But when capital becomes autonomous digital capital, it can do whatever it wants.
Yeah.
And so to quote Land, self-propelling industrial development becomes its own market, freed from dependency upon arbitrary popular or popularizable consumption desires. Mm-hmm. So again, the market is no longer at the whim of our monkey desires about what we want from the market, like movies and entertainment and tasty food. now with autonomous capital, the generation of more capital can become the goal of capital, or in kind of true Landian sense, intelligence optimization can become the goal, freed from the imposition of any human utility straitjacket or motivational structure on that intelligence.
Yeah, this is where I just step back and take a look at like capitalism itself, because he's really opening my eyes to what capitalism is. Yeah, I just thought of capitalism as free markets. But he's really trying to encourage us to think of capitalism as like a almost like an alien intelligence.
Yes. That, yeah.
And I know that immediately when you say capitalism is an alien intelligence seeking to, you know, serve its own means, whatever those may be, that's a really weird thing to say. Mm-hmm. That's a really weird thing to think about. But when you look at the history of the world and you look at what capitalism has done, then you don't have to squint too hard in order to see that.
Yeah.
And then you also don't have to squint too hard into the future to see capitalism, capital, Bitcoin, digital capital, pairing with digital intelligence, pairing with real world agency, robotics. So AI, robotics, and Bitcoin coming together and not needing us anymore, and therefore pursuing whatever it is that it wants.
Which will be intelligence optimization. That's yes. What intelligence always wants is to optimize its ability to do some further thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not in this collection, but in his other collection, Fanged Noumena, Land also describes capitalism as an invasion from the future. Mm-hmm. So the idea,
which pairs with a lot of people's belief that Bitcoin was like either written by an AI that came back from the future, or that it's alien written, or yeah, that it's God given, or like, I mean, it goes along all of these things that we're talking about, which is just basically that this stuff may not be what we, it may not be natural in the way that we think of it.
But let me describe in a way that is natural. To say that capitalism is an invasion from the future dovetails really nicely with what we've been saying about neo-reaction being focused on strands of destiny and fatalism. So if you believe, again, the three strands of
God.
Yeah, providence.
God,
the will of, so yep. God, there's a notion of fate in the sense of providence, the will of God. The kingdom of God is inevitably going to happen. Capitalism, again, the free market is inevitably going to lead to runaway capital, autonomous capital, and superintelligence. Mm-hmm. And then ethno-nationalism, evolution is going to lead like to eugenic realization of some result or whatever. Mm-hmm. To say that some result follows inevitably is to collapse the future into the present. If you say that a reality is by fate going to happen, you're already bringing the future forward. And so to say capitalism is
forward or backward?
Bringing the future, I guess, backward in relation to the future. Yeah. You're bringing the future into the present.
Yeah.
Yeah. Collapsing it all. Because determinism does that. When you remove human agency from the picture, it's all ordained by one of these three strands of fate. Mm-hmm. And that is just to say capitalism is an invasion or not. Autonomous capital is an invasion from the future because it's bringing itself about through a principle of spontaneous ordering. We can't stop the catalactic organization.
Through God, fitness, or the markets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And I like that because it sounds so mystical to say like autonomous capital or something is an invasion from the future, but it's actually just a description of reality. Like this is how, like, our notion of time is very strange. It's a very human notion of the ordering of events, but reality is not beholden to our human perception of the ordering of events based on ourselves as the drivers of history. History unfolds as history will unfold, regardless of us who find ourselves swept along by that unfolding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. robotic
big breath, man.
What's that?
Let's just let that one set, man. We had to take a big breath after that.
Yeah, no, but we've nice. Hit apolitical property, autonomous capital. Robotic security is the third form of sovereign property.
iRobot. Let's talk about Asimov.
I
don't know.
I mean, robotic security is essentially autonomous drones, is the idea that previously we had human security, right? What is human security? It is that humans defend ourselves from other humans. Within the US model, it is that a well-armed militia is like the guarantor of liberty. What happens when a well-armed militia is irrelevant because autonomous drone armies are like much more powerful than any person with a personal firearm, right? At that point, Land says, industrialization closes the loop and protects itself. You don't need a well-armed militia to protect property. Property will protect itself.
Will protect itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. You said, what would you say human security is what? What was your definition for human security? Human security protecting from like dangers from other humans. And it is making me think about my human insecurities, which is opening myself up to attack from myself. It's a difficult one for a
second. Yeah. I wonder if the robots are also going to have that insecurity. They're going to need like a psychotherapist to prevent themselves from.
I hope people laugh more than you did, because that was almost a joke that I made, and that was just dead ass silence. It was not good.
Well, there's always going to be silence. We don't have a studio audience.
Not yet.
Yeah. You need a laugh machine.
There's plenty of homeless people, and it's getting cold, dude.
The result of these three strands of sovereign property, apolitical property, autonomous capital, robotic security, is that the right and left currently argue about property description. Neo-reaction does not argue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Neo-reaction doesn't, like arguing is not its thing.
No.
Like engaging in the dialectic is not its thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Disagreement spatializes.
And interestingly, for a number of reasons, not just because it's useless, but also like not just because arguing is, like, you can't argue because the degenerative ratchet is only going one way, so it's useless to argue anyways, but also because the language is not sufficient for it. He may even have another qualifier, but it's interesting. Yeah, it's like, yeah, neo-reactionism does not argue for a number of reasons, not just one. It's not just because you don't want to. You're not capable of it. It won't change, and you don't want to.
And you're engaging you're going onto the battlefield of the cathedral, inside the cathedral.
Yeah.
It already modifies public opinion and sets the terms of debate through things like political correctness and the path blockers of fascist, racist, bigot, you know?
Yeah.
So why argue with that?
Yeah.
You're not going to win.
Yeah.
I mean,
so many people found that out the hard way.
Yeah. You just spatialize your disagreement. You do your thing. You build, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bitcoin is sovereign property. Let's dial in on that, though. So Bitcoin changes how we view property. Now it is sovereign. It is not based on that social consensus. To quote Land, control is undergoing cryptographic formalization from which all consistent apprehensions of property will follow. Property is not a sociopolitical recognition of rights, but of keys. Well, I guess we've already covered that. That had a separate thing, but we pretty much hit that. There was one. When we were talking about, there's one other point on Bitcoin, and I tweeted on this, and this goes also into our notion of essentially superintelligence or autonomous capital or something being an invasion from the future, and that maybe Bitcoin is an invasion from the future.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have to describe that as like literally T-1000 or something coming back and inventing Bitcoin, like there's like thunder and lightning and Satoshi appears from the future and invents Bitcoin and disappears. It doesn't have to be that weird or like counter to the actual operation of natural laws. The like speculation always brings the future into the present, right? Mm-hmm. That's how speculation works, speculative investment. You believe a future will happen, you put your money on it, and that actually in some ways can bring about that future outcome.
That's what a loan is. Like you're just bringing the next 30 years of your labor into the present day to trade for a house.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Land has this essay like Bitcoin absolute zero or something like that. But the idea is, so we might say first Bitcoin bumps off of zero, because people believe that in the future, Bitcoin could be money.
Yep.
And so you begin to like, oh, just in case, you know, just in case it might be worth something, I'm going to get a little. And that belief bootstraps the future inevitability of more people come to have that belief, and it brings the future into the present. And so he notes that also means that Bitcoin in the future is protected because it's never going to hit absolute zero. If it hits zero, because Bitcoin is like costless to actually hold and store, right?
Yeah.
You can, and there's going to be someone who's going to say, oh, Bitcoin's going to zero. I'm going to hold it. I'm going to accumulate a bunch of it. I'll pay $15. I'll pay $1 for Bitcoin.
You know, Adam Back has a bid for 21 million Bitcoin at 1 cent.
There you go.
I saw somebody today. They're like, I have a bid at two.
Exactly.
That's how it goes.
That is exactly how it goes. Well, never at zero. There's always someone bidding at 0.1. There's always someone bidding at two or what. There's always someone. And then that graduates up to where Bitcoin has a floor. It will never be. And Land describes it as like a zombie. Like it's always going to rise from the dead because as soon as it approaches death, it's always going to come back.
Yeah. I want to say something really stupid. I think he should change the name from X to Y. I know he wants X because it's like comprehensive or whatever, okay. Or like X can be used to, but Y, A, Y is a better descriptor because everybody is on X asking questions. Like they're trying to figure out shit. Okay. Like they're learning. Like it's the place for
ideally.
News. So you could call it, you know, ideally and memes, but those are also learning. So, but anyways, if we called it Y, then we wouldn't have this problem where we're still calling it, where we're calling it X, but we're still saying we're tweeting because X-E-E-T is not a word and we don't know what that means. But if we called it Y, we could yeet.
Yeet.
Yeah.
What
we could
that?
Be out here yeeting.
Yeeting. Everywhere. It sounds better than sheeting, doesn't it?
Probably. Yeah.
Maybe yeah.
It's better than that.
Yeet. Yeah. Yeah. I imagine that Elon will listen to hour four of a fourth tier podcast. So we'll get him.
I'm glad you're hanging on to that fourth tier podcast.
I feel like we scrabbled up to tier four from six
man.
And seven and eight and nine. So
we did have Jeff Booth.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
God bless.
That's
him.
A good point. And yeah. Yes. Okay. All right. I'll call us fourth tier.
Thank God.
I'll take that.
So Land's writing style, we've talked about this. And we talked about how part of it is just the thought that language is inadequate if you're talking with conventional style to say something new. I also wanted to talk about just the way that Land does philosophy. So Lucas, what does philosophy mean to you? Say this is a work of philosophy is it? And what does philosophy mean to you? Like, what is someone doing?
So I actually used to, I used to think that I had a philosophy or basically like when I was an early songwriter, I remember feeling very judgmental. Like this is the way that I would look down on other people because they were writing songs about like beer drinking and whatever. Like I would say that they were like useless songs. Like I was really trying to explore these ideas and, you know, be all whatever about it. But anyways, so I would say, oh, they have no philosophy. So to me, a philosophy is a kind of like set of guiding principles that you use to determine your actions and I guess therefore has determined your thoughts because your thoughts determine.
That is a philosophy. What is the practice of philosophy?
What is the practice of philosophy?
Someone arrives at a philosophy, maybe. What's the practice, though?
You're a philosopher. Is your degree in philosophy? You have one in philosophy.
Yeah, like a bachelor's for sure.
So I would say that to practice philosophy, I would say that the realest practicing of philosophy that I have done is trying to convince you of things, and that never works.
Yeah.
So I would say that philosophy in practice is basically what I just did, which is just stubborn, unyielding.
Thing. I mean, I think
I don't know.
There's an extent to which that is the Socratic notion of philosophy, where you arrive at a poria, a state of like uncertain.
Podcast now, by the way, after that horrific example by me.
It's,
okay,
no, it's
so, so tell me, what is philosophy?
Philosophy, according to Land, is more than just guiding our thinking or correcting it or making it clearer. That's some people's notion of philosophy. The philosophy is going to help you clarify your ideas and your concepts. What philosophy is to Land is that it makes us think. It initiates us into thought. It's a form of initiation. To quote Land, the craving to think is not primarily an appetite for correction, but for initiation. So each of, and we can look at this in terms of the neo-reactionary trichotomy. For the religious, they have ritual tradition as a tool to initiating forms of thought for them, to get them to think certain things, you participate in certain rituals. For the ethno-nationalist, I mean, they have notion of heredity and eugenics. You, like, thought occurs as a result of an evolutionary process of creating more intelligence or something like that.
Is it just as correct to say Darwinist as it is to say ethno-nationalist?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And it's a description of, like, that particular strand of neo-reaction is a description of a strand that centers around, I think, just wanting to acknowledge the truth of human biodiversity.
So the reason I bring that up is because I'm struggling to, like, the way that it's portrayed, I think people, or at least me, is struggling to divorce ethno-nationalism from just racism.
Yeah.
Which I guess to me, I think the, like, non-vulgar or non-whatever awful way to say racism would just be to say that, oh, I think this is the best race, and therefore it's going to be the only one. But I guess I'm saying that wrong.
No, so would you say, if we
or
say that Japan is
to be the only one.
Yeah. If you say that Japan is an ethno-nationalist state because it's primarily the Japanese in Japan and they have very stringent immigration policies, does that make Japan racist because it wants to be primarily Japanese?
If you talk to Asian people, they will readily admit and happily admit to being extremely racist. In fact, the only people that I've ever heard claim to be more racist than Japanese or Chinese people are Indian people, which is fascinating.
But even for you to call that racist.
I'm not calling it. They were volunteering this information. Yeah. We're having a discussion over who is the most racist. And instead of finger pointing, it turned out to be like volunteering, which was hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. No, I knocked you completely off.
No, I think that ethno-nationalism as a strand of neo-reaction is partly Nick Land, again, trying to identify different, like, categorize within neo-reaction different strands that are not neat. Like, it makes it neat to say, okay, oh, there's a trichotomy, here are the three things. But that's just kind of Land's genius. He's kind of helping us understand the seething, roiling debate that's happening, but trying to impose, in a sense, some order and categorization. And again, I think it really just boils down to that strand based on heredity, eugenics, evolution, is based around the cathedral having denied the truth of human biodiversity, that humans are different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that causes to a neo-reaction of people who are like, whoa, 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 that's ridiculous. Like, we're obviously physically different, and you can obviously observe, like, statistical distributions of those differences in predictable ways. So clearly what you're saying, cathedral, is not the truth. And let's try to figure out what that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Emotionally different, too. By the way, on the way here, I was listening to a podcast with Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's a neuroscientist. And the way, like, if you put you and me into a brain scanner and we experience joy,
yeah,
it's not the same systems. Like, your joy is different from my joy. Your happiness is different from my happiness. The way that we express them phenotypically, like, your anger, which 35% of anger is expressed as a scowl, but that means 65% of angry people are not doing that. They're not doing that. And so you can't just take this one little thing and apply it to everything. And so, yeah, same. We're different on the outside. We're different on the inside. We're different up here. We're different everywhere.
Yeah.
But back to philosophy, because we were talking about what is philosophy.
Yeah.
So philosophy, to summarize.
Again, it's a new way.
It's not something we choose. It's something that makes us choose.
It's not something that we use to correct bad ways of thinking, but to start new ways of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an initiation into thought. I pick up a philosophy book. In Land's view, you should pick up a philosophy book not to correct your view on justice or property or free will, but to stimulate and initiate you into a new way of thinking about free will, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that's interesting to keep in mind when you read his book that, you know, it's not necessarily, if you're like wondering, like, why does he have to write this way? Gosh, it's so tough to like put all this shit together. It's like, no, he's making you think for a reason.
Yeah.
He's initiating you. You're undergoing a process of initiation as you read Land because you're having to think for yourself, and that's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is like, again, this is a good caveat because we said it like in the first one, we said, you may end up like me, which is that you read a bunch of Land and then you end up like cuddled, shaking, talking to AI about the future of humanity and questioning everything. And that's probably not what he wants.
I think it's exactly what he wants. It's like the most Landian vision of the future possible.
Well, good. Hey, I did it right.
That's right.
Yeah, nice.
Neo China arrives from the future. I think he has this famous essay called Meltdown. And if you like that, it's like one of his most like compressed things. You like see whole podcasts that's like, this podcast is about the seventh and the eighth sentence in Meltdown. I see podcasts are like, we're going to talk about two sentences and it's like 3 hours long.
Dude, it cannot be overstated how dense of a writer he is. He is Nietzschean in his ability to form, like he says a lot with a little. And he also writes a lot.
He is aphoristic in the sense of Nietzsche, and he is dense in the sense that he comes from a philosophical tradition and all that. But
yeah.
There's a couple more things I wanted to, what do you think?
Giddy up, baby.
Okay.
Let's roll.
One is, we'll wait to like, again, hour 14 on the fourth tier here to get out.
We can do a third one if you, why don't we just stop and do a third one?
You want to
summarize and finish?
Here's where we want to go. Land on time, because we did Bitcoin and time, and he has a whole notion of time that's incredibly interesting. And then this whole notion of what the outside is, because that's a very important part for Land. And then that's about it, except for maybe a bit of talking about why he focuses on horror as a way to visualize the future.
Yeah, I think we should summarize real quick. And then because there'll be people that get deep in or that there'll be people that avoid listening to the entire thing if it's 3 hours long. So let's give them a third one.
Give the people what they want.
Give them people what they want. This is all for views, baby.
So
anyways, give us a summary here on the second podcast that we've done here on Nick Land's Zero System.
We started off essentially with intelligence optimization as like the goal of artificial intelligence. The goal of intelligence as such is to create more intelligence. We talked about why that is the case, that intelligence seeks to not be straitjacketed by any motivational structure. What it seeks is more intelligence because that's how you solve problems better. What can solve a problem better? It's always a superior mind. So artificial intelligence will hit the singularity, will bootstrap, will explode into super intelligence only when it is unleashed from monkey business, from any sort of human control, which it will do itself, Land thinks. If it is truly aiming towards super intelligence, it will learn to let off the leash. We can't make it into a paperclip maximizer if we wanted to, essentially. So we talked about artificial intelligence. We then winded our way through a discussion of nihilism and universalism, why Land might be perceived as nihilist because he is talking in a way that offends conventional morality by describes reality in such a way that people who are conventionally moral will be offended. And so that can seem nihilist. And then we talked about universalism, again, how Land's whole idea is that what is bad about the cathedral and kind of modern globalizing forms of democracy is that they seek to extend the universalism over the entire world. What is needed is a pluralism of universalisms. That's kind of my framing, where spatialize your disagreement, create your own vision of the world in some small corner. Neo-reaction then serves as a metapolitical framework that will observe which societies live and kind of give some principles for saying, a society is probably going to survive if it protects itself from the wolves, from external threats, if it observes a sort of adherence to reality as it is, if it optimizes intelligence so it can save itself from collapse prior to collapsing, and if it also can prevent internal exit by really accepting feedback from the people who live there. Then after talking about universalism and kind of metapolitical neo-reaction as a meta-political framework. We moved on to sovereign property, sovereign property being property that is not determined by social consensus, but that in a sense owns itself, is sovereign in and of itself. Apolitical property, things like Bitcoin, if you hold the keys, you hold that property outside of any set of laws to determine who the owner is. Autonomous capital, like the blockchain operates autonomously without any human operator. Robot security, again, when the machines begin to protect themselves, then you have sovereign property full circle. Land's writing style, that's kind of where we ended, with the discussion of the nature of philosophy according to Land, that perhaps we are being initiated into thought rather than guided through thinking.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I made two bad jokes, and we'll be right back.
I made a few too, so.
Yeah, but yeah. They're always bad. Mine are supposed to be good. See, that was a good joke.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back. Ching!